Good morning and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God. His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I am your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Wednesday, March 25th, we're studying Genesis chapter 34, verses 1 to 31. In today's text, Jacob's new Canaanite neighbors sin against his daughter, and her brothers plot for vengeance. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, Pastor Sean Kilgo. Pastor Kilgo serves at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Lawrence, Kansas. Pastor Kilgo, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
It's good to be back.
As we get started today, Pastor, remind us of the context as we prepare to look at Genesis 34.
Yeah, so the immediate context is actually one of the more familiar texts, the reconciling of Jacob and Esau with each other. And so that just happened. It's kind of fascinating, the order of this stuff, because you think as you're reading along, you get to the end of 33 and you're like, oh, things are looking up. And then you get our text today and you'll see, well, things are still broken and sinful and all that sort of stuff. The other thing that has happened very recently that is particularly important is the end of chapter 32 is where Jacob wrestles with God at the Jabbok. And this is where he gets the new name. You should no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you've striven with God and men prevailed. And our text is going to be the first time that that name, Israel, actually gets applied not just to the guy, but to all of his descendants, to the whole nation, right? And so you can miss it if you aren't kind of paying attention to that, but that is significant in the kind of immediate context. So you've had the reconciling, you've had the naming and all this sort of stuff, and we're getting toward the end of the what we might call the Jacob saga,
right?
Because chapter 37 puts us into the whole Joseph narrative, and in between this and that, you also have the whole lineage of Esau going on in chapter 36. So this chapter and next chapter are like really the last chapters that are zeroed in on Jacob. So he's not going to die until later on in Genesis, but he ceases to be kind of the focus of the narrative after this and the next chapter. And you already see kind of a bit of the move away from him as focus, even in this narrative, where his sons start to play a bit more prominent role, albeit in a sinful and untoward way, but they do start playing a prominent role, whether they should be or not.
Right. The only other bit of context that I would add, just because it's, although we know it, sometimes we don't always take it into account, is a little bit farther removed, but it's very important that Jacob has 12 children and 4 different mothers, and he loves those mothers and their corresponding children differently. And which
Correct.
Ones belong to which mother, again, although it's not specified every time the children are named, the fact that we're talking about there's going to be 3 particular children of Jacob, and they're all full siblings in this case, that's
right.
An important detail. And, you know, the way Jacob plays favorites with his kids becomes pretty important later in the narrative, too. You see hints of it already here.
Right. Yeah. So these are all from the same mom. Right. And like you said, that does play into account in all of this.
Yeah. So this is, as you noted already, this is another one of those moments in the book of Genesis where finally for one of the patriarchs, it seems like things are going well. They can sort of coast now. And that's not what happens by any means. Jacob's had another moment like this after he had run away to Laban. It seemed like things had taken a great turn. And then suddenly there was deception on the part of Laban. Here, Jacob's come back to the promised land. It seems like things are going to go well. And very quickly, they don't. So that's Genesis chapter 34. I'm going to read the whole chapter, even though it's a little bit longer, because there's some details that come out along the way that are helpful in understanding the story as a whole. So Genesis chapter 34. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. And his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this girl for my wife." Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah. But his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. The sons of Jacob had come in from the field as soon as they heard it, and the men were indignant and very angry, because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him to be his wife. Make marriages with us, give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. You shall dwell with us, and the land shall be open to you. Dwell and trade in it, and get property in it." Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me I will give. Ask me for as great a bride price and gift as you will, and I will give whatever you say to me. Only give me the young woman to be my wife." The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully, because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we agree with you, that you will become as we are by every male among you being circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter, and we will be gone." Their words pleased Hamor and Hamor's son Shechem. And the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. Now he was the most honored of all his father's house. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, "These men are at peace with us. Let them dwell in the land and trade in it. For behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men agree to dwell with us, to become one people. When every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised, will not their livestock, their property, and all their beasts be ours? Only let us agree with them, and they will dwell with us." And all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. On the third day, when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds, their donkeys, and whatever was in the city and in the field. All their wealth, all their little ones and their wives, all that was in the houses, they captured and plundered. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?" And that is where the text ends. That's Genesis chapter 34. All right, Pastor Kilgo, so the text begins by bringing up the one daughter of Jacob that we know about at this point. She was mentioned previously in Genesis among the children who've been born to Jacob thus far. She's the one that begins this story. Talk to us about what happens to Dinah in the first couple of verses here.
Yeah, so this is where it almost immediately goes off the rails, right? So
right.
Dinah is out in the land. The way this is described is really interesting. Went out to see the women of the land. And when you read the commentators on this, and including Luther, there's all sorts of different ideas as to what this means and how you take this text, that this description is very much going to influence how you basically how much blame, so to speak, you put on Dinah and this whole thing. So one of the ideas here is that Dinah is like the the very mellow view is she's just going out to like look around, like sightseeing, basically. The other one is that this is a way of kind of phrasing that she's going out and like imbibing on the like the Canaanite culture, basically, that's around them. And that I'm more inclined, I think, to that understanding of it. And it would maybe help to explain why she's by herself, right? I think it's something that's easy to miss at the outset of this. Dinah, for whatever reason, is unaccompanied in this land. It's not like she's walking around in her own village. She's walking around functionally in a foreign land. And I don't remember who it was. One of the people I was reading said that she's like 12 in this. I don't know how exactly you would figure that out, but I think most believe that she's fairly young, right? I don't remember if Luther says anything about this, but one of the commentators had said that she's like 12. So it would be akin to like, you know, I'm here in Lawrence, and there's a kind of the main strip, or the old kind of historic place is called Mass Street. It's Massachusetts Street, but Mass Street if you're local. And that's where all the like quirky shops and sort of stuff are. But also it's where you have a lot of people who are homeless or, you know, drunk or using drugs or all of the above are hanging out on that, and especially in the evening. So it would be like if I, you know, my daughter's driving now. So if I sent her out, said, "Hey, Phoebe, can you," it's like 9 o'clock at night. "Hey, Phoebe, can you go over to Mass Street and go to this, you know, go to the noodle shop and pick us up some noodles or something like that?" Unaccompanied. Like, I'm not going with her. I'm not sending her brother with her or anything like that. She's just going by herself. Like, that would be a very dumb thing for me to do to my daughter. It's putting her in danger. And that's sitting kind of in the background of this. Why is it that almost immediately she's just snatched up by Shechem here, right? But then, like, this is how it unfolds. He sees her. To me, this is interestingly reminiscent to when Jacob sees Rachel, right? Jacob sees Rachel and like immediately he's smitten. Well, Shechem is too, but that smittenness, we might say, is unbridled in this case. So he says he loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her, but this is right after he rapes her, right? So this is maybe a good example of, you know, just because you love someone or something doesn't mean, one, that that's actually an appropriate thing to love, but also it doesn't mean that you can just do whatever you want then because I love this person, right? And the Greek and the Roman world actually had a number of terms for this. They would talk about like disordered love. One of those is somewhat familiar to us. It's mania. So someone who is a manic is someone who loves in a disordered way, but one that is particularly destructive both to themselves and the one that they are attempting to love, right? So he shows his love for Dinah in seizing her and humiliating her, defiling her, right? And so this whole thing then culminates with him going to his dad and saying, "Hey, I would like this one to be my wife," right? So like it's exactly the opposite order of the way things ought to be going. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, so what is the connotation of went out to see the women of the land in verse one? You know, is that a more innocent sightseeing? Is there a hint perhaps that she's, you know, mingling in terms of the religion of the Canaanites there? It's hard to know and hard to say. Regardless of what her motive was, though, clearly the text portrays what Shechem does as wrong, especially in the way that verse 2 is very, you know, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. The repetition of those three different verbs, like Shechem is obviously in the wrong here. And it strikes me that he is called the prince of the land, especially in connection with the women of the land. And again, this is not to, none of this is to lay the blame at the feet of Dinah for it, but to see within this text a picture of what it means, like Christians live in the world. What do the people of the world, how do they respond to Christians? And the violence that we see here, I think is, again, that's not to say that Dinah's to blame or anything like that, but just to remind us of like, what does it look like for Christians to live in the world? What does the world do to Christians? And how should Christians respond to the enmity that the world shows to the church? I think is a theme that runs behind this, and we're going to see some helpful ways and maybe some less helpful ways as the text goes on in the way the church relates to the world.
Right, and I would say not only how the world views like Christians and the churches, but God and his order.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. I think this is maybe a good example of, you know, when Jesus says that we ought to have the wisdom of a serpent and the innocence of a dove.
Right.
That like you could apply this here, right? So we tend to think like we want Dinah to retain her innocence, right? Mm-hmm. But there should be some wisdom that's operating here. Like maybe it's not wise to go out. And for the other thing, where's all her brothers?
Sure.
Right now, I know they're out working in the field. Where's the dad? Like, where's anybody else? Like, why is there nobody else that's around Dinah?
Right.
Like, you know, either telling her, hey, like bad idea, or, you know, fine. If you're intent on going, I'm at least going to go with you so that I can help to make sure that you're safe. Right. So there's a significantly more blame to throw around, even just right in the first verse, and it keeps piling up. And like you said, I mean, Shechem, and he's even described this later. He's the most revered among all the sons of Hamor. So this seems to be kind of part of that prince of the land. But he's kind of the guy in charge beneath his father, right? So this reminds me of like a lot of the, you'll get these like TV sitcoms or whatever, where you get the mob boss that's like, he's the one ruling the city, but then his son is out there just kind of doing whatever he wants because his dad's the mob boss, right? I mean, this kind of strikes me as something like that. And even the way he goes to his dad is like, hey, get me this girl for my wife, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, and I mean, that starts getting into the whole deal of, you know, the corruption of marriage. We're talking about the way the world views God and his order, his gifts, all this sort of stuff. Well, the church and the scriptures do not depict marriage as being some sort of ownership or some sort of like bargaining token or anything like that, but a sacred one flesh union that is a reflection of the union that he has with his own church, right? Well, the world doesn't see that. So, you know, it's not really surprising. It's awful. It's wicked. It's evil. But it's not surprising that marriage would be treated in this way, right? By Shechem and Hamor and the whole nation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, we've got wickedness on full display here, brought against the people of Israel, particularly Dinah at this point. And as so, after Shechem makes the demand, I would say, not a request, but the demand of his father, you'll get me this girl. Then the text really shifts between the, I don't know, negotiation seems like too cold a term, but that's kind of what happens here. The negotiations that happen between the two fathers and as well as the sons, they're all involved in this. And one reason I read the whole text is because when you get to especially verse 26, where it says that the sons of Jacob, the brothers of Dinah, they took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. One thing that is maybe not apparent throughout the other parts of this text is that this whole time, Dinah is actually held captive in Shechem's house. She's not free to go. And I think you just kind of have to know that detail to understand. Again, doesn't necessarily make the things that happen right on the side of Dinah's brothers, but I think that detail makes it a lot more understandable the way that they act, because they realize their sister is being held captive over here. And as Jacob points out, the numbers of their family are few. They're not in this conversation from a position of strength. And again, I'm not saying that that justifies things that they do, but I think it makes it a lot more understandable.
Right. I think it, like, right at the outset, it helps to understand why Jacob is actually willing to negotiate, right? Because they can't roll in and just by force of will go and take Dinah back, right? They just can't do that.
Right.
So this is a good example of, there are a lot of instances in our lives because of the fall where we are faced with a set of decisions, none of which are good, none of which are according to God's order, and you got to do one of them, right? Luther, there's this oft-misquoted thing from Luther, sin boldly, but this comes out of a letter that he's writing where I always mix up who it was. Is Spalatin, maybe, or is Melanchthon?
I forget.
I think it's one of the two. They're trying to figure out what to do. They've got some conundrum that they're trying to deal with, and they're trying to figure out basically a way that they can do this without sinning. And Luther in the letter says, look, you're kind of making a category error here. You believe that there is a non-sinful option here, and there's not. And so, as it turns out, not making a decision is also sinful. Like, not doing anything is also sinful. So you need to make a decision. Choose the thing that seems to you the most wise and the least sinful. And that's where you get, and sin boldly. Mm-hmm. Just do the thing. But, and this is the part that never gets quoted, but trust in Christ and his mercy even more boldly, right? That Jesus has, in fact, died for this, and he does know, it doesn't excuse it, but he does know the situation that we find ourselves in this world, right? And so you can have some consideration and sympathy for, you know, Jacob and the brothers here, particularly Jacob and trying to negotiate, and the brothers trying to find some way to get Dinah back. But again, the way that instead of picking the least sinful option, I feel like they picked the most sinful option among all the things that they could do, right? So it just, again, keeps going off the rails. You think, sure, okay, this is going to get better. It can't get worse. And then it gets worse, right?
Sure. So in terms of, you know, which option they pick, and I think this is where I think the family dynamics may be in the background here, especially. So you're looking in the ESV, you've got verses 5-7 as a paragraph, where Jacob learns what has happened, and he holds his peace until the sons come. And when the sons get there in verse 7, you find out that they are indignant and very angry at it. And I don't, well, again, if you bring in the way Jacob responds to their action at the end and the way that the two brothers respond, I think there's maybe some family dynamics going on here where Jacob does not act with the same, well, imagine if this had happened to Joseph, just to bring, you know, go forward in the story. If this had happened to Joseph, what would Jacob's reaction have been? It happens to Dinah, and his reaction is really rather passive. And I don't want to read too much into the text, but I think that's a fair thing to say from the way the text goes. And such that, so I mean, if the family dynamics are like, hey, these are Leah's kids, Jacob does not love them as much as he loves Rachel and her one child at this point, then again, you can see why, it doesn't make it right, but you can see why I think the brothers of Dinah react the way they do when they're watching their own father not really doing anything. And so, like, you talk about which option to choose, again, not justifying it, but I think it becomes a little more understandable when that's in view too.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. So, like, if you, like, just fast forward to the way Jacob reacts when the sons bring the blood-soaked garment, right? It says, Jacob tore his garments, put sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, no, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning, right? I mean, it's a very different kind of visceral reaction, right? At least with great, great sorrow here. And you don't get a sense of that in this, and it may be there, and it's just not recorded, right? However, there is no sense of that, but this is where, like, okay, what ought these brothers then do? Not what they end up doing, but, you know, the proper thing would be to encourage and counsel their father in taking action, right? It's actually their father's job to take action here, right? So even like it would be if everything continues the same way and all the same events occur, but it's Jacob that does it versus Simeon and Levi, I think that actually paints this in a very different story, because the sons, part of the issue with this is that the sons are stepping outside of their vocation, right? This is actually not their job, right? It's their father's job, and they ought to urge their father to do his job. And there seems, for whatever reason, some sort of like reticence to actually do that by Jacob.
Yeah, and if this sounds familiar, it may be because you've read about King David and some of the same family troubles that he had when he didn't take the action that he should have as father, and his son stepped in and did things that they shouldn't have done. History repeats itself in the people of Israel, and I think we're seeing that ahead of time. Of course, this comes before what happens to David, but the story with David maybe is a little more well-read among Christians today than this one in the book of Genesis, but I think we've got some similar themes going on. We're going to keep looking at this text more on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Sean Kilgo this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Did you know that an investment with Lutheran Church Extension Fund exclusively supports LCMS ministries and church workers? That's right. LCEF ensures LCMS churches, schools, and organizations have access to the financial resources they need to sustain, strengthen, and start ministry work. In other words, you can feel good investing with LCEF because we share your Lutheran values and love for the church. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCEF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCEF investments are not FDIC-insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCEF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCEF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Back to Sharper Iron. It is Wednesday, March 25th. We're studying Genesis chapter 34, verses 1 to 31 with Pastor Sean Kilgo. He serves at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Lawrence, Kansas. Pastor Kilgo, prior to the break, we had looked at the second paragraph in the ESV where Jacob doesn't really do all that much. The sons of Jacob, particularly the brothers of Dinah, reacted with great anger. And before we move on in the story, I do want to at least mention briefly the point that you brought out. It's there in verse 7 where we hear the word Israel refer to the nation, the people as a whole, where it says he, that is Shechem, had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. Since you brought it up, I wanted to let you comment on it briefly before we keep moving.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing is just to notice that you have Israel being applied to the nation, right? To the descendants and just all the people bound in any way to Jacob, who's now named Israel. And I think this is just perpetually good for us to keep in mind because of the world that we live in, that Israel is a country in most of our minds. It's not the name of a people group, right? It's not the name of a genealogy, essentially. So in the Bible, Israel is a reference to the people who have come from Jacob. And if you skew that, then you're going to get some skewed ideas of what's going on. And this is then a picture of the church, right? So this is the Old Testament church of which we are grafted into as Christians is Israel. So you get, especially in the Psalter, all the stuff that'll come up and it'll talk about God redeeming Israel and God caring for Israel and all this sort of stuff. And if you have in your mind the country, then you can end up in some bad theological spots. But if you keep in your mind that this is those coming from Jacob, and which are the church in the Old Testament, and you just supplement Israel with church, which is what it is, then it starts to make a whole lot more sense. And it's why those things are actually still given to us today as Christians and are quite wonderful and comforting.
So as the text continues, then you have these conversations between the two parties, Hamor and Shechem, and Jacob and his sons. And the fathers are there, but it seems that the sons take charge somewhat quickly within both contexts. And just so that we try to talk about as much of this text as possible, because I know it's long or we may run out of time, I'm going to sort of bring some things together here and let you talk about it. On the one hand, when you hear Hamor and Shechem make their offer to Jacob and his sons, you know, it again, you know the great crime that has been committed, and yet their words sound pretty smooth, like, okay, maybe this isn't such a bad deal. But when you take the speech of Hamor and Shechem in verses 8 to 12, and then you compare it with what Hamor and Shechem say to their own people starting in verse 20, I think you see a little bit of deceit. And the reason I say that is because in verse 10, the offer that's made to Jacob and his sons is that, you know, the land will be open to you. You can dwell and trade in it and get property in it. So they say there's going to be economic advantage for Jacob and his family. But when they go back and talk to their own people, then verse 23, they tell their own people, hey, won't their livestock, the Israelite property and all their beasts be ours? So I think you, like, these are not good faith negotiations on either side. And I don't think there's any sympathy to go around, and especially not on the side of Shechem and Hamor.
Right. And again, to throw into the background, also Dinah too.
is being
held captive, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like they send her back and say, okay, let's, you know, this wasn't right. Let's figure it out. Let's make it right. It's, you know, we're basically holding this as a bargaining chip and let's get everything we can. And when you add in Jacob's comment that we've mentioned before, that his people is very small in comparison, this idea that their stuff is going to be our stuff is actually quite right. That the people of Jacob, of Israel, will pretty quickly just get absorbed into this people group, into the land of Canaan, right? I mean, it's just that they're too small in comparison, barring the Lord protecting them, which is right. It inevitably what does end up happening, right? I will say this, I think, to the modern reader, strikes people as very awful. Like, you know, ask for me a great bride price is the whole dowry sort of deal. I think it's just good to remember, like, this is actually the way in which marriages have been set up for a good chunk of human history across cultures, right? And a part of it was not so much, I think we tend to hear this as your purchase. Now, I think they maybe are trying to, like, just buy Dinah and functionally this.
However, the context of this chapter,
yeah.
Yes.
However, the purpose of the dowry in most instances, or the reason why it gets put into place, is actually for the provision of the woman, right? So you want to make sure that the person that your daughter is marrying can actually afford to take care of her, right? And so, and it's interesting because sometimes the dowries go in one direction, sometimes in the other, right? Sometimes you basically have a gift from the parents to the groom, and sometimes you have basically a purchase price, so to speak. And in either way, you're either saying, here is stuff in order to provide for my daughter because you're marrying her and she needs to be able to, like, stay alive, or prove to me that you actually have the means to support my daughter in marriage, right? And I think if you think of it like that, then it's actually a much better situation that is being put forward. But again, like that's very likely not going on here. It's just to, you know, this is an example of just kind of everything being used for nefarious reasons, right? Including, you know, the great gift of circumcision that's going to come up, right?
Yeah. Well, Just real quick, before we get to the circumcision, of all the things that are going way wrong in this text, One thing that does end up happening correctly is the temptation, if I can say it that way, of the initial speech of Hamor and Shechem, the temptation for the people of Israel to intermarry and just be, you know, swallowed up by the people of the land and their religion, that is avoided in this text. And that's
like, right.
The Lord working good through all of the sin, that is avoided. And I think that's such a huge Old Testament theme that that's at least one thing we should see in this text, even with all the bad things that happen, that temptation does get avoided, and that's a good thing.
Right, and that's kind of what I was mentioning earlier. Like the Lord does make sure that his people, which is what he's always promising, he will preserve his people. It may not be a big people, and very often it's not a big people, and that's okay. The Lord can do quite a bit with a very small amount, which he actually kind of forces the issue on a number of... My favorite is always Gideon, right? He whittled down the army just to kind of prove the point, right? The other thing that it's maybe worth just kind of mentioning is it is not improper to try and seek to right the wrong, so to speak, here in I will take Dinah as my wife, right? Now, again, there's definitely ulterior motives going on. You know, there's not good faith negotiations, all that sort of stuff. But to kind of set that aside for a minute and to say, you know, this is actually the counsel that we tend to give quite often, like as pastors. So you and, you know, this girl or you and this guy, you got together, you made a bad decision, you sinned, and there are consequences to that, but like you need to make this right, get married, right? So, you know, the guy that I remember, I had this actually at my previous call, we had someone, they made a bad decision, they sinned, she got pregnant, and we went through absolution, she was absolved, and then the very next thing was, okay, let's start planning the marriage, right? You have conceived a child together. This child needs a husband or a father and a mother. You have acted as though you're married. Well, we need to actually put all that right. So it doesn't validate the thing that's been done, but it does seek to move forward in a godly way in light of what's been done, right? And I think that's something to maybe see in there, even though there's, again, these sinful motives that are sitting behind this particular thing, the general idea of remedying the wrong by engaging in a godly action is correct. Instead of what ends up happening in almost all of these, that you try and repay evil with evil.
Mm. Right? So that brings us then to the other part of the conversation, which is the sons of Jacob, how they answer. And Moses tells us in verse 13 that their answer is deceitful, because of the reason they've defiled their sister Dinah, and again, she's being held captive, and their deceit even makes use of the gift of circumcision. So talk about that, paragraph, verses 13 to 17 there.
Yeah, and maybe one thing to point out, like, again, where's Jacob, right?
Sure.
Why is it that it's Levi and...
Simeon,
thank you, that are doing these negotiations, right? I mean, this is just way out of order, right? They are not the ones really that are even authorized to make this sort of negotiation, but here they are, they're making this negotiation, and you can kind of see the idea in their mind, like, hey, we don't have the raw force, but if we can weaken them somehow, then, you know, we can get the edge and get one up on them and go free our sister and all of this. And so, you know, there's a few options. Like, you could try poisoning them, you know, you could try like poisoning the water, food source, maybe blockade them, something, or you could use the gift that God gave in order to make you his people in order to slaughter them. And they choose the latter.
So right? In terms of this choice, and I know Moses says they're doing this deceitfully, but I do wonder, like, if their deceit was thinking they're going to give him an offer that there's no way they take. I wonder if Simeon or Levi are thinking, okay, we're just going to offer him this, and there's no way they'll do it. And then, of course, they do, and then they change the deceit. Maybe. I don't know if the text leans one way or another if they already know that they're going to, you know, take advantage of the weakness on the third day, or if they're maybe just thinking, ah, there's no way they'll do this.
Yeah, and I mean, and like you said, it just doesn't indicate. It's certainly an option. I'm maybe a little bit more jaded on it. I agree.
Yeah.
I just think that they know exactly what they're doing. They're like, this'll get them. And this always reminds me of, and not to like try and equate them, but like this is not an unusual tactic in history. And maybe one of the better known ones is Washington going and attacking the Hessians on Christmas Day, right? So there's like in more modern warfare, there's generally been this unwritten rule: you take Christmas Day off, right? And there's even these interesting things where you have like guys in World War One or Two that come out of the trenches and they celebrate Christmas with each other, and then they go back in the trenches and start trying to kill each other the next day, right? Which is just an odd sort of thing, but it was just generally understood you don't attack on Christmas Day, right? You take the day off, you set everything aside. And so the Hessians that are there, they're one of the major oppositions are for Washington. They get drunk on this day, and so they're all sleeping in their barracks and stuff, basically passed out. And Washington and his men just roll in basically unopposed and just kill them all, right? And this has always struck me as being rather similar to that. Like, the tactic is the same, right? So it's just this one by Simeon and Levi is significantly worse.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. One of the great ironies of the fact that, you know, the circumcision is the way that they end up deceiving is that, and this is kind of like you were saying in terms of when, with the idea of marriage, where there's, you know, things have gone in reverse order, and now that there's repentance, we want to live in that repentance. And so how do we go ahead and do that? Like, if you take away the context of the rape and all of the sin that's involved, and you think about people who are, you know, like those who desire to get married, if you have the Christian spouse, and then there's a non-Christian who wants to become a Christian. Like, I mean, you think about the number of people in our own churches who have, maybe they were, and this usually happens more interdenominationally, but someone married a Lutheran and then someone became a Lutheran because of that marriage and the joy that that brings, you know?
Right.
Like, if you take away the context of all of the sin that's involved, this could have been a wonderful thing that God is adding to his people through faith. But of course, there's all this deceit in the background, and that taints everything. And none of this is being done, you know, in actuality or faithfully. But if you remove all that, this could have been a really nice thing that the Lord brings people into the land or into his people, because that was the whole point of Israel, anyways, was to show the true God so that more would come to worship the true God through Israel. That's again part of the great irony, and then I guess the tragedy as well of taking this good gift of God that's meant for one purpose and using it in such a deceitful way.
Right. And I mean, on both sides, right? So the Simeon and Levi don't present it as a way to be God's children.
Right.
And Hamor and Shechem don't speak of it as being a way to be a part of God's children. It's both, on both sides, it's a means to a different end. Right.
Right.
And the analogy I've used on this is like, so for us, because baptism, I think, this works because baptism is the new circumcision, right? It would be like if we are talking with like a big group of people and they're at odds with us, is like, okay, hey, let's you know, let's resolve this. Let's go over to Clinton Lake and we'll get you all baptized. And then we can just all be together and we can resolve our differences. This makes us, you know, one family, all this, right? Even though there's more preaching than what's going on here. But we go down, and as soon as they, you know, come down into the shoreline, everybody that's there that's like helping to baptize just like holds their head underwater and drowns them, right? I mean, that is basically what these guys are doing, right? And I think that helps us to understand just like how horrific this actually is in the abuse of the gift that God had given in circumcision, right? It would be akin to us doing that same sort of thing with baptism. And that is just like unfathomable to think that a church or a group of Christians or whatever would do something like that, right? And yet that's exactly what they do.
Yeah, and to do it on like on Easter Sunday, because it's on the third day, verse 25. Right. I mean, anytime you hear the third day, usually you're thinking Easter, resurrection, and here the third day is the day of this destruction and misuse and abuse of God's gifts.
Yeah, and then like, and then everything like flips, right? Instead of Hamor and them getting, basically absorbing the nation of Israel into themselves, it goes the other direction, right? They took their flocks, their herds, their donkeys, whatever's in the city, all their wealth, all their little ones and their wives, right? So like, you know, there's like this payback thing, it seems, going on there. All those in the house they captured and they plundered, right? So it's not that they like they draw the little ones and their wives, because everything's just grouped together. The children and the wives are not like brought in or depicted as being brought in as a, like, we're going to take care of you now that we've like killed all your men. But instead, they're plundered, right? The kids and the wives are part of the plundering of this group. And this, I mean, later on in the various narratives, like this happens over and over where like Israel will do this in other instances where God had commanded them not to do it. And you get the explicit command, like, don't do it. And it's almost like you can hear in the background a reference to this, right? Don't do what Simeon and Levi did, right? It was wicked. Don't follow in that train.
Hmm. Yeah. One thing, again, not this. None of this is to justify it, but to see, as you note, that the opposite of what Hamor and Shechem thought was going to happen ends up happening, that Israel ends up plundering the people of the land. Again, this isn't to justify it, but it's remarkable how still the Lord is faithful to his promises, that even in all of this wickedness that's happening, he is still faithful to what he said to Abraham, that those who curse you, you know, will be cursed. And as we've seen on a number of occasions, maybe another good example is when Abraham goes into Egypt, says that Sarai is just his sister, but he ends up bringing a bunch of treasure out of Egypt. Again, from a motive that was not pure, the Lord still worked his good for his people. Something similar happens here. And again, that's not to justify what happens, but it is to note how, as Joseph will say at the end of Genesis, what men intend for evil, God works for his good.
Yeah, and also like Paul kind of doubling down on this, that he works good, all things, for those who love him, right? So like you would imagine, like, if you're reading this and you don't know what happens, right? You would imagine that the effect of this, either just naturally or from God himself, would be like, okay, I've tried. I am done with you. We're going like plan C now, right? And yet, as the next guest will talk about, like, the very next thing is, you know, God re-ups his blessing upon Jacob. And he continues blessing the messianic line through him. You get Joseph coming along that the Lord uses in order to make sure everybody can stay alive. Just everything that should just be completely destroyed through the actions of Simeon, Levi, of the inactions of Jacob, of the deceit of Hamor and Shechem. Just the Lord works through all of it, right? And some of the things he will use in order to specifically bring out good, and some of the things he just basically overrides, right? He works past them.
Yeah.
And this is where, like, you can see this, you can see texts like this, and you can look at the lives that we live and the world that we live in, and just the complete and utter wreck that surrounds us, and see that, you know, the Lord does continue to be faithful. The Lord does continue to provide what's needed. The Lord does continue to forgive sin. The death of Jesus is still effective for us. All is. And I mean, it's interesting, like, yeah, Simeon and Levi get passed over. Reuben, firstborn, then Simeon, then Levi. None of them get the blessing, the primary blessing. It goes to Judah. And yet, like, Simeon and Levi play pretty important roles in the preservation of Israel, you know, the most obvious being the Levitical priesthood, right? So the priesthood, even though it's a Judaic line biologically, It is a priestly line that flows from Levi, right, that Jesus will take up. And so even there, like, you can see, like, the Lord just steps into the middle of the sin and the muck and just the nastiness of all of this, and he fixes it, right? And it's not perfectly fixed yet, but it will be on the last day. And, you know, we can rejoice that in spite of the sins that are committed here by Jacob and Simeon and Levi, that we'll see them in the resurrection, right? And that's how deep the mercy of the Lord flows.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got about 2 minutes here, Pastor Kogo. Any more details from the closing conversation between Jacob and these two sons? And especially, you know, with a text like this, so much sin, how does Genesis 34 point us to Christ?
Yeah, I mean, in addition to what I was just talking about, I think the other thing maybe to keep in mind is that, you know, the abuse of something does not destroy the blessing of something. So God continues to use circumcision as a blessing for his people. And he does it all the way until he gives us what it is a shadow of, and that is baptism, right? So we have baptism today because of circumcision, right? And so God has continued to kind of press that all forward in spite of the great abuse of it here. In spite of the abuse of marriage here, God continues to bless and uphold the goodness of marriage. You get all these things that get abused in this text, a disordering of God's good order. And yet God continues to come along and set that order in front of us as a good thing. And I mean, all of that comes to a head in Christ. Like, Christ puts the order back into place with all of this. I mean, he takes up marriage, he takes up the priesthood, he takes up circumcision, puts us into baptism, you know, all of these things. So in himself, he reorders all these things for us. But it's, I think, always a really good reminder that just because something gets abused by people in the past or people today does not mean that God does not continue to set that in front of us as a good thing by which he gives us all of his great goodness.
Pastor Sean Kilgo serves at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Lawrence, Kansas. He's been helping us today to study Genesis chapter 34, verses 1 to 31. Pastor Kilgo, thanks for being our guest today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about Genesis 34, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we begin to read Genesis chapter 35 to see the faithfulness of God to his servant Jacob and his family. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.